Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be interviewing the two authors of the lovely book out from Bloomsbury at the end of 2022 titled Black Out Here, Black Lives in Scotland. And we have with us both of the authors, Francesca Sabande and Leila Roxanne Hill, to talk about this book that explores both the history and the contemporary lives and realities of Black people in Scotland, reflecting on the past to make sense of the present. And I personally found that this made rather a lot of sense. And so I'm very pleased to welcome the both of you to the podcast today to tell us about your book.
Hi, thanks again for inviting us to do this.
Hello. Yeah, I'm really happy to be here.
Before we dive into the book, could I ask each of you to introduce yourselves a bit and explain why you decided to write this book and write it together?
Sure, yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Francesca Sabande. I'm a writer and senior lecturer in digital media studies at Cardiff University. And there's probably a lot of time we could spend just speaking about like why this book and why we've written it in the way that we have, but I guess one of the main things that is at the center of it all is a love of Black lives in Scotland, and also an awareness that when Black history in Scotland is spoken about, rarely is there a focus on recent decades and recent years. So we wanted to try and contribute to ongoing work and conversations about all of that, whilst knowing that there has been a lot of writing and a lot of just being and creativity that's come before our book.
Hi, I'm Leila Roxanne Hill, and I am a writer and curator and community organiser and trade unionist. I think just what's already been said, that there's at the moment quite new work coming up, or newer work that focuses on, you know, older histories of Black people in Scotland, particularly those that focus on the transatlantic slave trade. So we were quite keen to have something that was a little bit more contemporary and included the experience and built upon work that has been made, even if some of that might not be considered work in an academic sense, in more recent decades.
So I'm glad that you've both mentioned kind of where this fits in, but very much what it adds to the conversation in terms of kind of who's being focused on what sorts of things and the time as well. So I'm wondering if you could maybe tell us a bit more about that, right? Who and what is being focused on, and how did you kind of, given that the scope is expanded, how did you decide sort of how and to what extent that can be opened?
So I think essentially, although we have our own experiences of being Black in Scotland, and that's definitely shaped, you know, aspects of the book. So there are some personal reflections in there. There's some personal photographs as well. The book's really about the experiences of many different people. So that includes people we spoke to as part of interviews, people who kindly shared like their personal archives and just, you know, spoke to us about the experiences of family members and friends throughout the years. There was a survey element as well, and we spent quite a lot of time looking at press clippings, different archives that were available to us, especially online, because the bulk of this work was during the COVID-19 pandemic. So I think the question around, you know, whose experiences is the book about is a tricky one in some ways, because we're really making clear there's no one Black Scottish experience and there's no one experience of being Black in Scotland. But the different perspectives and experiences that are spoken about in the book or reflected on include those of people between the ages of like 18 to like 70 plus, if we're thinking about the survey, or the experiences of children as well. So parents speaking about, you know, what it's like for their child to be Black in Scotland right now, or adults reflecting on their childhood, you know, in days gone by. And yeah, there's no one Black Scottish experience. There's no one way of, you know, living as a Black person in Scotland. But I guess our hope is that our book highlights just some of the many differences and similarities between the experiences of various people, while also recognising that no book could ever capture all of what it can mean to live that life.
Yeah, and I think in terms of how it was decided, I guess it was the response, you know, we put out the survey, we had an outline of what we'd hoped that the book would have been, but this had been decided long before the pandemic. So obviously there was the sort of worldwide recognition of Black Lives Matter. So a lot of the book ended up being sort of decided by events that, you know, overtook us, but also the ways in which people responded to the survey and the ways in which people spoke to us whilst they were being interviewed. So it's kind of worked in a way that, you know, there's not one thing that's influenced or decided how the book takes shape. It is, and we're very fortunate, it is the people who have contributed, you know, their experiences and their knowledge with us that's helped shape that.
I'd love to tell the listeners a little bit more about kind of the survey for that you both spoke about creating for this book, because it is I think perhaps a little bit unusual to see a survey that does get so much sort of personal feedback and responses that really add to kind of all the other things that come into the book. So could you maybe tell us a little bit about how you approach creating this survey and how you thought about sort of analysing the results?
So we've got a section in the book which is us thinking about how we wanted this work to really focus on people and not percentages. And I guess that hopefully gets across the way that we try to approach the survey. So we really wanted to try and provide as much of an opportunity for people who wanted to or felt able to share about their own experiences in their own words. And we were aware of, you know, for various reasons, including the impact of the pandemic, that, you know, not everybody would want to have, let's say, an interview over a call, and not everybody might have the time for that either. So the survey was a chance for people to respond to various questions about their lives as Black people in Scotland, either right now or if they'd previously lived in Scotland or if they had an ancestral connection to Scotland. And it's very much qualitative in terms of we're not focusing on statistics, we're not focusing on numbers. And that's partly because we're aware of the fact that oftentimes, especially when we're dealing with academia, Black people are treated as nothing other than, you know, so-called data. And there can be this real emphasis on numbers in a way that is essentially, you could say, you know, reflective of the anti-Blackness that we acknowledge throughout this book. So the survey, it's maybe not necessarily what some people would expect of a survey, including in terms of like the number of responses or the way that we focused on the quite detailed reflections that people have shared. But to us, it was never about there being this sort of supposed value in a quantity of responses. And we wanted to try and recognise the value in anything that anybody was happy to share with us. And that also meant doing the work in a way that wasn't just about Black people who might be viewed as public figures or institutionally affiliated. So some people who we interviewed decided they wanted to be anonymous. Some people we interviewed went by their names. And some people that we spoke to might be publicly known in various ways. Others aren't. different, and that felt a really important way to do this work, particularly to ensure that it's not simply just reproducing what came before or feeding into the respectability politics that can result in just a select few Black people becoming the face of or the so-called authorities of Black Scottish history and Black lives in Scotland.
Yeah, and I think just to add to that, that there has been, you know, it feels that there's always been like an onus on, well, it's such a small percentage, or, you know, the population of African Caribbean people in Scotland are so small that it's almost insignificant in a way. So we wanted to show that, you know, despite that data, which again, not everybody can participate, you know, if you think about the census, for example, you know, not everyone can participate. It can put people at danger, at risk. So we wanted it to be an opportunity for people to say just how they feel, without worrying about being a research topic, you know, or a research subject, and just being able to speak freely about their experience and knowing that, or hopefully knowing that it was going to be put into a book in a way that wasn't going to put them at harm or be exploitative in any sort of way, but still speak quite, you know, strongly to the reality and to the experience that they've had here in Scotland.
Thank you for talking us through sort of the many things that you considered, because I think, Francesca, as you said, the survey may not be what people are expecting, but I think a lot of these factors that the both of you considered in putting it together are things that should be more expected, and making sure that subjects, you know, feel safe and don't necessarily feel like subjects and feel able to participate across a range of experiences. So I think that's really helpful to understand kind of both what's in the book and how you got there. And sort of similarly on a, I guess, kind of a methods question, Francesca, I believe it was earlier, you mentioned that the book has photography. And I thought this was really interesting, especially in the context of Scotland, where so often the images that people think of are quite old, right? And they tend to be like castles and churches and things like that. And so I was wondering if you both could help us understand kind of how did you approach using photography? What did you want? What kinds of photographs? What was the sort of goal of including that, not as sort of an insert just in the middle of the book that you flick through in the midst of text, but much more integrated?
Yeah, so in some ways, some of the questions around like what was the approach or what was the goal, they sometimes feel like quite odd to respond to, because I do think a lot of the way we've created this book together has been, you know, shaped by forces out with our control. So I think we always knew that we wanted there to be like a visual element, and you know, we're both people who love exploring photography in different ways, and we were also aware that there were people doing brilliant photographic work to do with Black lives in Scotland, and for those reasons, I guess it there kind of feels like there's maybe some sense of like serendipity, and some sense of like responding to what was going on in our lives and the lives of other people at the time. So some of the photographs are images of our own. We're aware that some of them might seem quite abstract or random to people. They might mean different things to us in comparison to how they're interpreted. There is also the really brilliant and beautiful photography of Najma Abakar as well. And there's some images from elsewhere, so places like Getty Images, so images, for example, of some of the different Black Lives Matter activist protests that were going on during that time. But I think maybe to come back to the question, if I'm remembering it right, around like what was the goal or what was the approach? You know, Black lives in Scotland aren't just about words, and we're also aware that people engage with books or work or ideas in lots of different ways, which includes drawing on photography. And we wanted the majority of these images not to be about just depicting Black people, but to hopefully convey a sense of, you know, what it might mean to move through Scotland as a Black person, the everydayness of Black lives, the mundanity of, you know, being out and about and just experiencing a different space. So what the images might mean to people, you know, we're not entirely sure, but I guess it's to try and just communicate yet another element of Black Scottish history and Black Scottish lives without feeding into the objectification of Black people or treating them again as, you know, individuals to just be captured, photographed and consumed.
Yeah, I think quite similarly to the survey, it was to show, I guess, the fullness and the wholeness of what Black lives can be without having to have your photo, you know, put in for a particular reason. Some of the conversations that we've had, you know, around the book, like public events, you know, and people have said that they've found their photograph, you know, just on the front of a book or on the front of a funding brochure for something, and, you know, they've had no connection to that whatsoever, and they've not had, you know, permission asked. So it's like we wanted to make sure and that it wasn't just, you know, there are definitely Black people here are their faces, or here are them, you know, being in Scotland. It was just about partly our experience of, you know, being Black in Scotland, and we said, you know, there's some of our own personal photographs in there, including some that show our family, but again, not their faces. We asked Najma just to provide us some photos. Some of those were prior to the pandemic, and then some of those were during the pandemic. So again, you know, that was Najma's experience of being, you know, a Black woman in Scotland, coming through in her, within her photography. And even though some of these were taken at the same time as the images that we had from Getty, it feels that they're quite different. You know, Najma's a professional photographer. Some of the images from Getty were professional. Some of those were taking images that could be considered quite similar, but you can sense the difference because, yeah, you know, Najma's a Black woman moving through the pandemic and moving to Scotland. But then with the Getty images, you know, it's like we're focusing on this BLM slogan, you know, we're focusing on this. So, yeah, I guess we just wanted to show the wholeness, the fullness without the explicitness, I guess.
And this is obviously something that is a tricky balance to strike in a lot of ways, especially thinking about this idea of sort of how much of it is history, how much of it is the present, how do those things sort of relate to each other? And I mentioned the phrase that I think is on the blurb of the book, right? The idea of reflecting on the past to make sense of the present. Maybe you two could help us, how can we think about sort of that idea of how are we telling history or centering the present and kind of putting those things in conversation with each other without either losing the history or kind of emphasizing it too much and forgetting the present?
So I think that maybe one of the many, I don't even want to say themes, because I think all these sorts of terms can be sort of, you know, like categorizing and compartmentalizing, which maybe relates to what I'm thinking about in response to this question, but something we've been thinking about a lot as part of this work and speaking about as well and writing about is the fact that, you know, history is here and now, it's right now. So I think even that sort of question around like the present and history, there's sometimes this false binary notion of past and present or even, you know, future, in a way that sort of betrays the messiness of how time works and how lives are experienced and how history is always happening. So I think it's not that we've necessarily been grappling with, you know, how do we hold on to the present whilst also thinking about Black Scottish history. We've been viewing Black Scottish history as the here and now, and that means of course acknowledging what came before, but also seeing all of this as very much, you know, an ongoing collective history that just cannot be contained, you know, by a single book or even by like terms such as past and present.
Yeah, and I think it is sort of reflected in the books. I think somebody said to me, it's like, well, it's very, very current, you know, because we made mention of an event that happened, I think, later into 2021. And that was the thing, you know, it's things that are happening now that we may not sense or feel as historic, I guess. Because there's this idea that if something is historic, that it has to be like a big event. You know, but even if we're thinking about, for example, the pandemic, you know, that is something that, you know, we're still moving through, but there's maybe an expectation that, you know, where's the bigness of it, you know, where's the bigness of this historic moment, and where's it as perhaps in the more smaller ways that we see and we experience things, you know, it I guess, like for me, it's even just, you know, making eye contact with somebody and smiling at them in recognition of, you know, your experience, you know, or sharing, being with somebody at an event or in somebody's house. You know, it's all these things that maybe aren't considered or told to be historic, which are the things, you know, that, that make up our history. And it is happening now. It has happened before. And it can help shape the future for sure. So yeah, I think it's just it's the messiness and the interconnectedness of it all, and that maybe we are too keen to say this is something that's historic, you know, this is something that's contemporary, this is something that's in the past. Something which we hope that comes through from the book is that, you know, some of the things that people speak to happening in the 70s and 80s very much comes through, like in the 20s and the 10s, you know, so everything's interrelated, everything's interconnected, and most of our experiences are too.
So that, I think, came up, as you said, in a lot of ways in the book, but one of them in particular I'd like to discuss is obviously the idea of education, and that so much of these experiences is not taught. And even the simple, I don't remember which of you mentioned it earlier, but even the simple kind of statement of like, no, there are Black people in Scotland, is to some people kind of surprising, despite the many experiences now and over time. So I was wondering if you could maybe speak a bit about the insights and reflections that came on this topic of kind of making sure that Black history in Scotland is properly taught, and maybe talk a little bit about kind of how it was all interrelated. This wasn't the at least my reading of it was not that this was a survey response of, oh yeah, that would be a good policy idea. It very much is interlinked with people's everyday experiences now, and this being something that links up and joins up with many other aspects of life, not just kind of maybe what sounds like a dry curriculum question.
Yeah, thinking about that question, I suppose something that comes to mind is, I think you mentioned sort of sometimes people will expect there to be like this policy recommendation, and this maybe goes back to some of what we've spoken about earlier on, but it feels as though often, whether it's in Scotland, you know, elsewhere in the UK, elsewhere in the world, oftentimes when, you know, we're dealing with different examples of writing or research or, you know, work that might be viewed as academic in various ways or scholarly, it feels as though that there's this focus on something translating into policy recommendations, or there's these terms and concepts like impact that are really often more harmful than they are helpful in any way. So I think, you know, as your question is sort of getting at, something that came through from the survey responses and also, you know, the interviews of people who so generously made time to speak with us, was that this is a lot more than a call for Black Scottish history to be added to a curriculum. This is also thinking about how, you know, education in general functions. So, you know, for example, one person we spoke to shared so much about the Black education that had, and Black consciousness raising specifically, that had been facilitated by family members. So thinking about, you know, a sister sharing books and resources with them, and other individuals who would speak about the fact that there would be a space where they would come together with friends, with other Black folks in their area, and essentially just, you know, focus on knowledge, Black knowledge that they knew would never be a part of the formal educational institutions that are so often sort of held up as the pinnacle of learning in society. So of course there were some people saying that the curriculum needs to include Black Scottish history across all different levels of education, but there were also people making clear that this isn't simply about, you know, reform or asking to be included in existing institutional context. This is also thinking about how Black knowledge and Black learning can function in ways that aren't dependent on these institutions or dependent on sort of precarious forms of funding that so often are sort of dangled as part of equality, diversity and inclusion, EDI efforts, and rarely do anything sort of meaningfully support Black people and support the sort of Black Scottish history that we're discussing. So yeah, I feel as though just one other thing on that is that when Black Scottish history comes up as part of public or political discussions, there's often this focus on previous entries, and it's just to sort of reiterate the point that we keep speaking about, to do with Black Scottish history being the here and now, and being the everyday, being the mundane, and being about so much more than whatever is supposedly recorded or written down. It's felt, it's experienced, it's not always taking the form of something tangible and observable, and it's not always actually happening in ways that Black people necessarily want to be made available within certain institutional contexts.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, that even, you know, and this is similar across, you know, different topics that, you know, we can, I don't know how many conversations had with people, it's like, well, I wasn't taught that, you know, particular aspect of history. So even if, you know, things were added to the curriculum, I think a few of the political parties made promises in the last Scottish elections to include Black history as part of the curriculum, at least as an online module. You know, so even with that, you know, it's not the wholeness. You know that it wouldn't be the wholeness that maybe people rightfully deserve. And, you know, that's not just exclusive to Black people. In Scotland, like, that's for everyone. You know, it's like we all deserve to have a more fuller and more whole understanding of each other. And I think there would be a tendency, you know, for it to be focused like either on a particular person. You know, it's like just looking at through some of the, or sorry, looking through and doing our research of some of the informal, formalized education attempts to discuss Black history, it tends to be, oh, there's one person who's doing this thing, you know, and let's hold them up, you know, and it isn't about that, and that doesn't help us grow together, you know, if it is just the one person that's or one person's experience. Not to say that it shouldn't be included, of course it should be, but as part of, you know, a multivocal like knowledge sharing. And I think just to echo like what Francesca said, a lot of education, you know, takes part in less formalized settings. You know, it's the sharing of information, it's the creation of space for people to learn, talk, and that might be done in ways that aren't considered academic enough or as part of, you know, Western educations enough, you know. And I think it'd be unfair to do that. You know, it's like when we think of conversations that happen in, you know, pubs and restaurants, you know, in cafes, on the street, you know, in the workplace. And, you know, this is how people, and recently as well on the picket line, you know, this is how people learn from each other. And yeah, I think it's, if we've been asked, you know, it's like, what are the policy recommendations? But I guess like that isn't what the book is about. Hopefully people, you know, who create these types of things or are responsible for it will read the book and maybe, you know, take aspects of that to create policy. But again, like hopefully in ways that are more considered and more full of care than previously.
So this idea of kind of growing together and taking into account things that might not traditionally be seen as academic enough, I wanted to ask about how the book sort of thinks about archives and uses archives and thinks about what is an archive and how to put one into something like a book. So I was wondering kind of what would you sort of say on that, particularly as I think there's probably a lot of scope for other people to have a more open-minded approach to archives the way that you both do?
I guess, thinking just off the top of my head, you know, it's like we put in some of our own personal photographs, some from our families. And I think our attention had also been to, you know, go to markets and see like what photos like were written about in there and just, you know, see what we could come across. Letters, postcards, you know, anything that might give hint to, you know, a Black person or Black people living in Scotland. Unfortunately, yeah, again, because of the pandemic, like we weren't able to do that. So we were drawing like on our own. But I think, you know, with the ways in which things have changed significantly, you know, speaking to, I guess, some younger people, by that I'm saying people under 20, you know, who are saying that they're now finding a lot of their information like on YouTube or Instagram, You know, online in different ways. You know, it's like we know that there's like many like groups that are set up, so instead of actual physical spaces, you know, where things are documented in perhaps more formalized like ways, you know, there's, that's an archive there, like in a chat group, you know, there's an archive, you know, in somebody's Instagram, there's an archive and things, you know, that again, like it's not formalized or considered considered worthy to go into an archive, but these are all things that can contribute to our understanding of, you know, being in the same place, you know, and be that Scotland with each other, you know. So yeah, I think it's just we did try to access some archives online, and that was quite difficult as well. So again, who has access, and then even if you do access it, like what is contained within that, like what is considered important enough to go into an archive, you know. And it's like I think of some of the things that like I collect, and you know, going through like some family members' things recently, you know, why do people choose to collect things, you know, why is there a receipt that might not be considered of any particular note, but then if that place is closed down or is no longer there, you know, it does speak to something, and it does speak to like a history. So yeah, I think it's like we, in much the same way that we're talking about, you know, rethinking history and how that is or how it's seen to be, I guess we have to think about that in terms of archives and who is it for. At the moment, it feels that, you know, the archive is still for people who have the knowledge to be able to access it. And it shouldn't be about that. It should be something that's, you know, a lot more open.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that whole thing of, you know, various formal archives or institutions thinking about what they feel is like worthy of inclusion is always so harmful, and such a reminder also of the fact that there's like this emphasis on value or like so-called like added value in a way that's really, it really contrasts with I think how many people will go about like keeping things that are meaningful to them, or keeping things that remind them, for example, of different family members or different friends or people who have been a part of their life at various points in time. And I guess what I mean by that is some of the people we spoke to as part of the book would share such, not just, you know, detailed reflections about their lives, but would also share examples of, you know, say writing or self-publishing or creative work that they were doing at, you know, different points over the 80s, the 90s and so on. And I think that in various spaces, people would reflect on those sorts of conversations or those sorts of ways of sharing and would say, you know, well, first of all, they probably say, who was it that did that? And then I think institutions would think about, you know, is this person deemed like worthy of their life or their experience or, you know, their knowledge being archived? And then beyond that, there's these pretty hideous questions around, you know, who they feel should or shouldn't get access to that archive material. And all that really is to say that I think archiving, and I would want to recognise that I don't know a lot about archiving relative to many other people, and I know that there are people who speak about the fact that it's a term that's sometimes sort of thrown around and become meaningless, but I feel that through our work we're thinking through how archiving can mean different things and be approached in different ways, and also just really acknowledging that a lot of what is happening on a personal level for people can take the form of an archive, but that doesn't mean that any individual or any institution is entitled to know about that personal archive. And, you know, figuring out how you do or don't want to share what you might have archived is a process that can be tricky and can also involve a sense of vulnerability that, again, I just want to recognise, you know, the people who spoke to us and shared with us embraced. And that is something that I think can be very difficult for people to sort of sit with.
Thank you for raising those points. I think they're very, hopefully will help people kind of think through an archive rather than just sort of going, oh yeah, I know what that is. I don't, you know, I've thought through all the pieces. I think probably a lot of people haven't. And so that's a really useful reflection. And I sort of want to kind of bring that into thinking about the people that were willing to speak to you both, were willing to share and make available their work, particularly in the sort of community organizing and grassroots activism sort of space. Can you maybe talk a bit about sort of how you approached and worked with these people in documenting and in some senses archiving their work in the book?
Yeah, I think, no, forgive me if I'm incorrect with this. My mind's very confused about timescapes at the moment. But I think, you know, these are some people that we'd had conversations with and like previously that, you know, we're quite familiar with, close with, had worked with. And when we said to them that we were, you know, working on this, some people were quite happy just to have a chat with us, recognise like the importance of, you know, speaking about their experience. And again, particularly some are very, very present, you know, in more recent years. And some of the people that we spoke to, you know, had experience of being in Scotland from the 70s and 80s. So it was quite, yeah. I think it was just, we were very fortunate that people were open to speaking to us, you know, and it's like we already knew of some of the work that had been done with the African Caribbean Women's Association. And again, fortunate to have somebody who is involved and had been involved with them for quite some time to speak to us. You know, we knew the work of Lothian Black Forum, and again, you know, we were very fortunate that somebody who was involved with the organisation at the time, or, you know, the group, the forum even, was happy to speak to us. And I think there would have been so many more people, and sorry, there's also somebody that's involved with Women of Colour Scotland. So I think it's also just in a sense that even if the people that we spoke to weren't part of groups and organisations that were more known to us, through the conversation it became quite clear that, you know, there was work that these people were doing like in their everyday, which is community organising, you know, as I don't like to use this phrase, but activism, you know. So yeah, I think we were just fortunate that it's, again, you know, it's like some of the people that we spoke to, we knew had been involved with, you know, groups and organisations. And then through conversations with others, it became quite clear that they were doing work in their own community, which again, you know, perhaps isn't documented as such, or it's not seen to be because it's maybe not specifically Black activism. You know, somebody that's working like in a gardening group in their local community, helping to create like growing opportunities. So, you know, that's community organizing.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that with us. And I think those are some great, a great point to remind listeners that, of course, the book itself has far more detail than we're going to be able to get into now. So if any of these things that we've been discussing, and particularly any of those examples, sort of pique your interest, there's lots more to learn about and explore in the book. But before we end the interview, I would like to ask about a few of the sort of policy aspects, not really in the sense, or I hope not in the sense of kind of, well, what are the policy recommendations from the book? Because Francesca, you've already made the, I think, very accurate point that that is not the work that this book is doing. But I was really interested that some of the people that you spoke to in this, to come up with this book, kind of would bring up a lot of these policy things and particular sort of terms. And Leila, Roxanne, I believe you mentioned sort of promises from politicians sort of would come up, especially, for example, the term New Scots, and kind of policies related to it about multiculturalism in Scotland, and kind of what does Scotland, or at least the government, kind of like to say is the identity of the country today in the 21st century. I was wondering if you could maybe tell us a bit about kind of those discussions as they came up in the book around multiculturalism in Scotland and how being Black in Scotland fits into that?
So in a way, I find it quite tricky to think of a clear example, and that's maybe part of our answer, in that I definitely don't think that this book was ever intended to be, and isn't, a book about multiculturalism. And I know that, you know, people will interpret things in loads of different ways. So it's always interesting to hear other people's points of view. And of course, we do have writing in the book on multiculturalism, so I'm not saying otherwise. But if I guess one of the things we were conscious of is that oftentimes when Black people in Scotland are acknowledged as part of, you know, political discourse, they're often only acknowledged alongside like the language or the idea of multiculturalism. And that's sometimes in a way that either sort of upholding these neoliberal notions of multiculturalism that involve overlooking the specifics of anti-Blackness, intersecting forms of oppression, such as, you know, sexism, ableism, classism. Or when these conversations to do with multiculturalism occur, it's based on this idea of, you know, new Scots and old Scots, which is something in the book we try to critically think about. Well, what does it mean to even refer to some people as new Scots, and who are the sort of implied old Scots? Or what does it mean to push ideas or rhetoric that is focused on this concept of inclusivity that puts sort of the onus of responsibility on individuals to essentially sort of integrate their way out of experiencing inequality and structural oppression. So the book is definitely not about multiculturalism, but we try to critically engage with how multiculturalism is and isn't discussed in relation to Blackness and in relation to Black lives in Scotland, whilst also recognising, you know, work that has happened that's intended to be in support of the lives of Black people, but without glorifying any of these efforts, because we're conscious that it oftentimes examples of activities that are intended to, you know, address racism or to address xenophobia are just sort of uncritically praised because of what's viewed as a good intention, and that can result in changes happening or agendas or policies being put into place that definitely don't support the people that they're allegedly intended to support, or will involve sort of grouping a lot of different people and a lot of different experiences in a way that doesn't account for distinct differences between them.
Yep, and I don't think I've got too much else to add on to that.
Fair enough, that was a very good answer. Thank you, Francesca. As we come then to the end of the interview, I'd just love to invite both of you, really. Is there any sort of final takeaway you'd like readers to take from the book? Is there anything you're currently or looking to work on next you'd like to highlight? What would you like to leave us with?
Big question for a Monday. I think maybe one of many different things that there would be a hope that people maybe not take away but feel when reading this is just like a sense of life, and a sense of, like we've kept saying, the here and nowness, but also like the beautiful sense of like ongoingness and collectiveness that can be and is a part of Black Scottish history and the experiences of Black people in Scotland.
Yeah, I think it's part of a bigger and broader story. It's more than what we've written, right? You know, it's maybe a helpful marker. You know, it's something that people can, you know, turn to, refer to, and we hope that, you know, it's a contribution to a much wider and broader work that either is, you know, institutionalized, you know, by being published, but, you know, it's, we hope that it encourages people to recognize and see and feel that there, you know, there is more out there or out there even, you know, and it isn't perhaps in the ways in which we expect it to be. You know, it's like, look out for self-published things, you know, it's like, again, like just encourage conversation and just be more aware, like, of your hearness and who's here with you, I guess.
Wonderful. Well, that's a lovely way to conclude, and a brilliant segue for me to remind listeners that the title of the book is Black Out Here, Black Lives in Scotland, published from Bloomsbury in the end of 2022. Francesca and Leila Roxanne, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having us, Miranda.